I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. As senior pastor at historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the Reverend Raphael Warnock preaches in the spiritual home of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. That's a giant legacy, one informed by a theology of liberation and social justice, and one that Raphael Warnock embraces. But he's not at all convinced that the American Black Church generally accepts justice work as central to its Christian identity. Today on Midday, Raphael Warnock examines the question of the Black Church's mission. Is it about saving souls or transforming the social order, promoting the gospel of prosperity or decrying economic disparity, personal piety or social justice? A rich conversation ahead with the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church after the news from NPR. And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. In this hour of the show, we have the pleasure of conversation with the Reverend Raphael Warnock, the fifth senior pastor of the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the spiritual home of the late Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Daddy King before him, and Dr. King's grandfather, A.D. Williams, before him. The history of the American Black Church, the theology of liberation and social justice, and the King legacy are very much a part of what informs Raphael Warnock as he preaches and practices his faith today. It is the subject of a book he's written about the American Black Church, examining some fundamental questions about the church's mission. Is it about saving souls or transforming the social order, promoting the gospel of prosperity or addressing economic disparity, helping people find their way to personal piety, or helping society achieve justice for all? Raphael Warnock seems not at all convinced that the American Black Church, which celebrates the legacy of Dr. King, generally accepts justice work as central to its Christian identity. Before taking the helm of Ebenezer, Pastor Warnock served for 4.5 years as the senior pastor of Baltimore's Douglas Memorial Community Church. Our conversation today is occasioned by the publication of his book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, Theology, Piety, and Public Witness, published by NYU, New York University Press. So, Reverend Warnock, thank you for joining us here on Midday. It's a pleasure to get to speak with you.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here with you and to talk to folks in Baltimore, my old stomping ground.
Yeah, I wonder, before we get into the subject of your book, we could talk a little bit about your days in Baltimore. Would you reflect on those years for us?
Oh, I was honored to serve as senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church. That church has a storied history and commitment to the struggle for freedom. The longtime pastor of that church, Marion Bascom, was certainly an activist in his own right. And the movement led by Dr. King was carried out by incredible leaders and foot soldiers there on the ground. And Marion Bascom was certainly one of them. I was proud to serve as pastor of that church from 2000 to 2005. And I have fond memories of Baltimore, and I often long for some real crab cakes.
Well, come and visit us sometime.
Sure.
It's great to have you with us. And I wonder, before we get too deep into this, the title of your book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, folks might wonder, what church is he talking about, the Black Church? Generally, as we converse about this today, how do you define Black Church?
That's an excellent question, and it is an issue that is debated even among scholars. Let me say what I don't mean. And when I say the Black Church, I don't speak in any exclusive racialized terms. I'm talking about the anti-slavery church. That church among the American churches that was born fighting for freedom, that was born insisting that of one blood God has made all nations to dwell upon the face of the earth, that we are sisters and brothers of the Creator. And so Black people in America, enslaved in this American context, have had to reconcile their Christian identity with the reality of struggle against racial oppression in America. And consistently their answer has been that God affirms the humanity and the personhood of all of us. And that's what the Black church represents at its best.
When you talk about the divided mind, I've kind of set this up a little bit about what you're exploring here. The idea of the a life of salvation for sinners, the work toward that that goes on in the Black church versus the social ministry, the calls for justice that folks identify with Martin Luther King Jr. And is that pretty much where we are in that divide?
Yeah, I attempt in my book to discuss what I see as the central tension in Black Christianity. As you very powerfully described it in your introduction, it is this tension, it is this creative tension between an emphasis on souls on the one hand and society on the other. This tension and dialectic between personal salvation and social transformation. I argue that Christian faith at its best, not just Black Christian faith, that faith at its best, not just Christian faith, emphasizes both. But in order to maintain that balance, you have to be very intentional. It requires critical thinking, deep commitment, and engagement with those who are on the margins of society. And so the book is written really as a call to arms. It looks back at the history of the Black church, traces that history through four distinctive moments, which underscore its historic commitment to liberation, while recognizing that even the Black church has not always been true to that fundamental commitment, that whole liberationist thesis. So I call the Black church back to that, and what I aim for is really a coalition of conscientious people within the Christian faith of all races and people even outside of the Christian faith who are committed to what Dr. King called the beloved community, even as they address their own concerns for personal piety and spiritual formation.
Mm-hmm. You know, when one reflects on the history of Dr. King and just watches the current events today, the way politics plays out in the country today, issues come up, events erupt, people go to the streets sometimes to protest. They go on, television and speak out about various issues. One could have the impression that there's solidarity in the Black church when it comes to these issues, particularly economic issues, questions of economic justice. But that isn't exactly true the way you describe the Black church in America today.
Yeah, the Black church is by no means a monolith, which is why some people push back when I and others speak about the Black church. But when I recognize that it is not a monolith. It is a complicated phenomenon. But at its heart, for profound historic reasons, has been this emphasis on justice and justice making. I mean, it is the one church in America born responding to what I see as America's original sin and its most enduring social problem, that is racism. I mean, there was a real effort in the early days of the nation and even prior to the nation among those who were engaged in the enslavement of other human beings as a form of enterprise and industry to somehow reconcile that to Christian faith. And so part of how they did that was to try to separate bodies from souls, to say, well, we've enslaved the Africans, but it's really for their own good because in the process we have Christianized them. We have exposed them to the Christian faith. Black people never accepted this kind of truncated understanding of spirituality. They understood that the God who wanted us to be liberated spiritually, understood that spiritual liberation has profound social implications. And so that first moment that I talk about in Black people's struggle to apprehend an anti-racist appropriation to Christian faith was really the formation of a liberationist faith. That is to say that the slaves were not simply converted to Christianity, that they converted Christianity itself and transformed it into a liberating faith. And so The master would preach, slaves, obey your masters. That's somewhere in the book. It's in Ephesians. But somehow, slaves who could barely read somehow stumbled into the Exodus motif where God tells Moses to tell Pharaoh to let my people go. And it is out of that kind of sensibility, enslaved people creating their own spaces, wrestling with the mystery of God under the dark cloak of night after the official church religion, church meeting was long over in the deep darkness of night in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia. That's the first moment. That's why Albert J. Raboteau, still the foremost really scholar on slave religion, says that the difference between the master's Christian faith and the slave's Christian faith, he said, was wide and deep. Mm-hmm. Howard Thurman said, by some amazing but vastly creative spirituality, the slave undertook the redemption of a religion that the master had profaned in his midst. So that's the first moment. And then out of that comes the second moment, the founding of a liberationist church. And that is literally the formation of independent black churches and independent black denominations, formed not out of a kind of segregationist impulse, but really out of a burning desire and witness that insisted that indeed in Christ there is no East or West. There is neither slave nor free. And so they sought to bear witness to that in their own churches. And for decades, black people developed their own kind of distinctive faith, which resonates and is expressed in different ways. We saw that show up in 2008 during the election of Barack Obama. Some were exposed to the kind of exuberant spirituality of black faith and its politics, and we're wondering what in the world is going on here. Well, black people weren't surprised. We see that every Sunday morning in our churches, this kind of profound spirituality, deep, palpable, animated, and attached to life, refusing to truncate one's spiritual commitment to one's commitment to what Dr. King called the beloved community. So that's the second moment. And out of that comes Dr. King's movement. I mean, you really wouldn't have a Martin Luther King Jr. Fighting for freedom in the larger society if you didn't have a Richard Allen and Absalom Jones forming the African Methodist Episcopal Church in the 18th century, and so many others who formed independent black churches. They created these autonomous, independent spaces. And when the time was ripe, the spirituality of the black church at its best, this commitment to freedom that embraces everybody, literally poured out into the streets, confronted the American nation, a putatively Christian nation, and said, live up not only to the true meaning of your creed in terms of your charter documents in the nation, but in terms of what you profess as people of faith. That's what Dr. King said. That's why Dr. King said that when he traveled to the South, through the South, in that famous letter from a Birmingham jail, somewhere there he says, when I travel through the South and I see the impressive religious buildings and education buildings and churches and the spires that point heavenward, he said, I ask myself, what kind of people worship there and who is their God? And so in this moment, as black theology raised that question, coming out of the civil rights movement, James Cone and others, I'm raising the question in a new moment in the 21st century. I'm asking people who worship in black churches and white churches and multicultural churches, who is your God? And what are the implications of that faith for the struggles of those who are on the margins of society in this moment?
The Reverend Raphael Warnock, senior pastor of the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, is our guest in this hour of midday. He's the author of The Divided Mind of the Black Church, Theology, Piety, and Public Witness, which explores the need for the black church to return to its original social justice mission. Our conversation with Reverend Warnock will continue in just a moment. And welcome back to our conversation with the Reverend Raphael Warnock, a senior pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. His book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, Theology, Piety, and Public Witness. And, you know, very compelling history that you can recount for us there, Reverend Warnock. But it sounds like, are you trying to persuade others to believe that this is the history, the legacy of the Black church in America, and that the church needs to return to that social mission, that mission of liberation?
Well, I think that this notion of what I call cultural or historical amnesia is an American problem. I think Americans have a very short memory of their history in general. And so it's not surprising to me that Black people who are sitting in the pews of this institution that's been so central to our struggle for justice and freedom in America may in some ways be disconnected from that history or have only a kind of marginal understanding of it, particularly in the decades following Dr. King's death. In those decades, even with all of the struggles and ongoing challenge and fight for freedom and for equity and parity, economic parity, certainly in the African-American community, we have seen a large and burgeoning Black middle class. And increasingly, there is this disconnect. That is to say that in some ways, the Black church gives lip service to Martin Luther King Jr. And no one can beat us in celebrating Dr. King and on King Day and other days. But Dr. King came to see freedom fighting as central to the church's meaning and its mission in the world, as central to its very raison d'etre, its reason for being. And so while most Black churches are engaged in some way in the community, most are in some ways helping the poor, feeding the hungry, I am not convinced that they see struggling for freedom, raising the public policy questions that ask why are people hungry and homeless in the first place. I am not convinced that they see that as central to their work. And so often we celebrate Dr. King while channeling Jerry Falwell and some others with a kind of uncritical emphasis on personal piety, a kind of uncritical evangelicalism. And you know, I'm evangelical in many ways. I certainly believe in my own personal walk with God. My parents are Pentecostal preachers. And so that informs who I am as well. But evangelicalism that is disconnected from a larger social vision is dangerous. And we're seeing that now, how it shows in the ways in which it shows up in the society, that the most conservative voices, in some ways, the most mean-spirited voices that emphasize a kind of bedroom politics but ignores the hungry and the homeless and the struggling and those without health care, come from the faith community. And that is the scandal of the American church. And I attempt, as a person who is operating from a pulpit, to call us back to what I think the faith is about.
You know, some of what you say resonates with Catholics, given what we've been hearing for the past year under the new Pope Francis. I can't help but make this comparison, although the comparison's a little different. For instance, the Pope is trying to change the mission change the emphasis. He sent an emissary to Baltimore. Annual Conference of Catholic Bishops was held here last year, imploring the bishops to spend more time tending to pastoral duties, one of the things the Pope wanted to see, less time being cultural warriors in the culture wars, shepherds right, living with the right. smell of the sheep. I'm sure you heard him say that. In a remarkable quote, he said, "I prefer a church which is bruised, hurting, and dirty because it has been out on the streets." Some of this just resonates so much with Catholics.
I must say that I am a proud Baptist, but in recent days I have a Pope. And I think it's an apt comparison, actually. Here is a Pope who was influenced by liberation theology, which for a long time was as embodied by the liberation theologians in Latin America, was sort of marginalized in the Catholic Church and seen as persona non grata. But he's embraced it. it certainly informs his religious sensibilities. And when you look at the response that the Pope has gotten from many of those who come from a different kind of perspective, it underscores the larger cultural problem that I'm trying to address in the West. I situate it within the Black Church, but it's really a Western theological problem. Here's a Pope who comes forward emphasizing the poor and embodying it in the ways in which he is leading as pastor and prophetic voice. And there are those who upon hearing what he has to say about the gospel and justice and the poor, they say he's a Marxist. And as if the witness that he's lifting up is not somehow embodied in the sensibilities of the Old Testament prophets who said he has shown you, O mortal, what is good and what does God require, but that you do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with your God. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. And so we are experiencing such a crisis in genuine and authentic spirituality in the American church that when it shows up, we see it as some foreign, some strange ideology. Although I don't think, although the Pope said that he knows some Marxists and they're pretty nice people, but we don't recognize in his call that we be more attentive to those on the margins of the society, that we challenge this trickle-down economics, he said, which is a kind of, fairy tale thinking that somehow prosperity will magically trickle down. We've tested that. It hasn't worked. We've been hearing it since the early 1980s at least. And when it shows up and when we hear this kind of voice, we hear, well, it's Marxist. No, this comes from the Palestinian peasant who walked the streets and showed up in the temple and preached in Luke chapter 4, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because God has anointed me to preach good news to the poor.
The Pope referred to the tyranny of unfettered capitalism and the idolatry of money in this document that he released late in the year, last year. And, you know, there are those in that church who call for more social ministry by the church, believing that that's where the best work of the church is done, where the emphasis should be, which is similar to, I think, what you're calling for here in the Black Church.
I am calling for that. And even as I hear the call of liberation theologians and Black liberation theologians calling us to be more intentional and more committed to the struggle for justice in the society, I look at the ministry and the witness of someone like Martin Luther King Jr. And I underscore and I caution that even as we fight for struggle, fight for justice in the larger society, that we have to pay attention to the ways in which a profound piety and spirituality is what gave Dr. King the courage to stand up to fight. And sometimes the Black theologians, those who operate in the academy, have been guilty, if the church has been guilty of not paying attention enough to the struggle for justice in the society, those who are the spokespersons for liberation theology, for Black liberation theology, have not always been attentive enough to the ways in which people need the reserves of a kind of spirituality and prayer life and spiritual formation that gives you the courage to stand up against the tragic limits of history. We see it in the autobiography of Dr. King. There he was in the struggle in Montgomery, Alabama, and he used to tell this story all the time in his sermons about how one night in Montgomery, Alabama, as they were engaged in the Montgomery bus boycott that propelled him into international fame, that he received a call late one night that shook him up. And he said, by that time, he had grown accustomed to receiving literally dozens of calls threatening his life on a daily basis. But he confesses that this particular call that night, in which the angry voice on the other end of the phone said, you better get out of town or we're going to blow up your house. And he thought about his wife and his young daughter, his firstborn, who was in the next room, and he was shaken up by it all. And he said he began to think about all the theologians that he had read in graduate school and began to try to wrestle with a philosophical understanding for the meaning or meaning of evil. And he said, none of that gave me any comfort. And he said, a voice came to me and said, you've got to tap in to that God that your mother and your father used to talk about down in Ebenezer Church, the faith, you know, of those in the Sunday school, ordinary people of faith, praying and trusting God for their ordinary lives. And he said that although he grew up in the church, that night, faith in a new way became real for him. And that moment, that encounter, that personal spiritual encounter is what grounded him through the next 13 years of travail, private travail, public struggle, threats against his life, and trying to figure out what to do next. And so we've got somehow to hold these things in tension. A spirituality that is tested by its commitment to justice in the world, and a commitment to justice that is dogged and determined because it's grounded in a profound spirituality.
The Reverend Raphael Warnock, our guest here on Midday, is senior pastor of the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the spiritual home of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. His book is The Divided Mind of the Black Church, Theology, Piety, and Public Witness, which explores questions about the church's mission and the need for the church to return to its original social justice mission. So, Reverend Warnock, we'll take a short break here and then continue our conversation in just a bit. And back to our conversation with the senior pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the Reverend Raphael Warnock. Reverend Warnock, I was wondering, listening to you talk about this, if there are times in your ministry you've felt, not alone, but that you could have used more support, more feet on the ground, so to speak, from brother pastors across the country, be it the time of the Troy Davis episode in Georgia. Troy Davis, of course, who was convicted of murder and was executed in Georgia in 2011, despite many emotional pleas and protests. To spare his life. You served as his spiritual advisor when he was on death row. There are other times, a Trayvon Martin episode comes to mind, and generally, and as we're looking at Congress and efforts in Congress to cut off unemployment benefits for people, looking at the unemployment rate in the country, questions of economic disparity that continue in our society. So are you calling for more support? And then secondly, I just wonder, isn't the call out really to all people of faith, white or black?
That's exactly what I was going to say. It certainly is a call to people of faith and to freedom-loving people in the United States of America, I mean, and across the world. We are in a critical moment in our history as a nation. And the direction that we will go is our standing in the world and what we stand for and what we're committed to really is at stake. Our future is at stake. And now more than ever, we need to hear the voices of faith. And I'm embarrassed as a clergy person, as a pastor, as a preacher. I'm embarrassed by the silence of the church. Dr. King used to say that there comes a time when silence is betrayal. And so there's been support, you say, by brother preachers. There's been support by, I have to say, some of my sister preachers and many of the most vocal and prophetic voices on the American landscape right about now. Some of them you may not have heard because they're not on television. They mm-hmm. they don't necessarily have the largest churches. Have been women who have insisted that not only do we struggle around this issue of racism as a contradiction, but that we deal with sexism and misogyny in the society and in the church itself. I think like one in four women are abused or molested in some way in their lifetime. And so when I think about a movement as great as the civil rights movement, our greatest movement really is not behind us. Our greatest movement is in front of us. When we talk about the liberation of women in the world, half of the world, half of the civilization, half of our country, then we're really talking about freeing all of us. And so we really need to hear the voice of the church when it comes to poverty. When we address issues of poverty, we're often talking about women and children. the silence of the church on this issue of climate change. I'm encouraged that there is emerging, it seems, a new generation of younger evangelicals who are recognizing the need to address some of these issues, climate change being one of them. And this is something we've taken on at the Ebenezer Church. And this growing gap between the haves and the have-nots, the problem of wealth inequality in the United States of America is critical, not just for poor people. The future of the nation is at stake. We know those who have traveled just a little bit around the world know what it's like when you walk the streets of a society where you have no middle class, where you have a few elites who have more than enough, and the vast majority of people can barely get by. Is that the kind of society that we want to have? And so this issue of wealth inequality is not just a buzzword. It's a moral call. And the notion that somehow we can balance the nation's budget on the backs of the poor and the elderly is misguided. And when the church is silent in the face of all of this, it gives its consent. And to the degree that it gives its consent, it bears false witness. It bears false witness against the God that it claims to love.
Reverend Warnock, I have an email here from one of our listeners in Woodstock, Maryland, Emma. It's really excellent. I want to pose it to you. She notes first a comment about the discussion that we just had about Pope Francis, who she says is inspiring. He said that the Catholic Church has to be careful to share the gospel, not just to pursue social justice. Otherwise, he said, we are just another NGO. Note that. But then she says this. She says, I am an evangelical, and I am enjoying this conversation. My pastor stresses that his purpose is to equip his congregation spiritually so that they are able to follow the Spirit's call and serve where they feel led. As such, we have no direct church ministry. Can you respond to this form of biblical perspective?
Well, I need to know a little bit more about what that actually looks like and how that shows up within the life of their congregation. But it is the job of a pastor to equip the membership in terms of their spiritual formation. But what the only thing that I push back against as a theologian is any notion that somehow spirituality is something that is detached from reality itself. I mean, there's a way in which you go deeply inward to tap into the life of the Spirit. But the only way that the New Testament calls us to test the Spirit. And we test that, for me as a liberation theologian, by the depth of our commitment to the poor. And I think that we have read faith through Western lenses of the Western lens of rugged individualism, and that's been the case so much so that even when the Bible is clearly addressing social issues, we don't see it, and you wouldn't know it listening to much of the preaching that comes from the American pulpit. I mean, Jeremiah and Amos and Isaiah and Micah, that's almost all that they talked about. They weren't simply challenging a few individuals who somehow veered away from Israel's commitment to the God whom Moses met on the side of the mountain, that God who said, I came to deliver you out of oppression, out of the hand of Pharaoh, into a good and spacious land. That God calls them over and over again to covenantal commitment to that fundamental principle. And it shows up in terms of how they respond to widows and aliens, even as we struggle with this question about immigration in America.
We've got about 5 minutes left together, but I wanted to take a moment to talk about Harriet Tubman here, partly because March 10th, yesterday, was Harriet Tubman Remembrance Day. Harriet Tubman was died on March 10th in 1913. She was born in Maryland into slavery in the 1820s, or I think it might have even been 1820. But her story, I think it's worth hearing from you on this because of the spiritual nature of the Harriet Tubman story. A lot of people are familiar with her work as an abolitionist and liberator. But, you know, how was she informed spiritually? I think that's important here for this discussion. Might be a good way for us to wrap up our hour together. This idea of personal and social salvation coming together and embodied in Harriet Tubman.
Yes, I mean, she is a profound example, and she represents the best of that slave tradition that I was discussing early on in our conversation, that the slave tradition and the faith that comes out of that moment in the development of Black Christian faith really holds together in a profound way this kind of balance that I'm pointing to between souls and society, between personal spiritual formation and the struggle for justice in the world. And yes, Harriet Tubman had a profound spirituality. She was a member of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, the AMEZ Church, which, by the way, was known as the Freedom Church because so many abolitionists and so many of those who were struggling against slavery came out of this church. And she returned to the South, I think, 19 times to rescue her sisters and brothers out of slavery. And someone asked her at one point, you know, how in the world did you manage to free so many slaves? She said, well, I would have liberated even more of them had they known that they were slaves. And so this kind of radical spirit, this kind of bold vision for the world itself, as you point out, was deeply and inextricably connected to her spirituality and to her faith. And just as that served her in the 19th century, I think it would serve us well in the 21st century.
So how do you get more movement here? What is your suggestion among your many suggestions from the book? What can you leave us with here, Reverend Warnock?
Well, part of what we need, I think, is a stronger push from the pew. We need, I'm grateful for the email from your listeners and those who are engaging the conversation. I think very often the movement and the struggle for justice, sometimes we're looking for leaders, and we certainly need them in the pulpit, and we need political leaders, and we need elected leaders, but much of that leadership is right at the grassroots. And I think wherever you find yourself, I think you have to make sure that your voice is heard. I'm on my way when I leave this interview to go to the Georgia Capitol, where the issue of gun control is being debated. Here we are, a year and a half or so after Sandy Hook, and the Georgia legislature is getting ready to pass perhaps the worst kind of gun legislation that we've seen in the nation. Literally guns everywhere, in churches, schools, bars. And I'm one of just a few faith leaders who's made my way down to the Capitol along with others. Plenty of people are concerned about this, but somehow you've got to get concerned enough to actually make your voice heard on this and on so many other issues.
We also, I wanted to note here in Maryland, we made some progress, some important progress on gay and lesbian rights in Maryland with the recognition of same-sex marriage. But we had a very bitter debate in Maryland, and it came in the churches. A lot of it came from the pulpit.
Well, yeah, I speak to that issue in the book, part of how I challenge the Black church is to think about its own struggle for justice and its own struggle for freedom. The Black church has never fought against anybody's rights. And I recognize that there's diversity of opinion within the faith community around this issue. But the fact of the matter is we live in a pluralistic democracy, and our commitment is to equal protection under the law. And either we believe in equal protection under the law or we do not. And so I said to my congregation the week that the Supreme Court decided to uphold those who were saying, no, we're not going to support the, I'm forgetting the actual legislation at this point, but they had a move earlier this summer, last summer, to support marriage equality.
Right.
And on the very next day, they had a vote about voting rights. and they stripped Section 4 of the Voting Rights Law, and which was a major setback for voting rights in this country. And what I said to people at Ebenezer Baptist Church and to other African Americans and others, that you can't be mad about what the Supreme Court did on Wednesday and mad about what it did on Thursday.
Right.
Either you believe in equal protection under the law or you do not. That is our covenant with one another as an American people.
Well, Reverend Warnock, I certainly appreciated having you on this hour and enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Always good to be in conversation with the good people of Baltimore, Maryland.
The Reverend Raphael Warnock, senior pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. His book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, is published by New York University Press. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Another hour of midday in just a moment, folks.